So welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming. In just a few moments, we'll return to our formal teaching. But again, I just wanted to reiterate something that I just said earlier. Again, which is important to remember, that we are not here to become great meditators. We are here really to become happy people, calm people, peaceful people, centered people, grounded people. And so therefore, while we utilize various practices to help us develop these capacities, please don't be confused that this, you know, by the technology. It's really about our humanness, our humaneness, and that these practices are about allowing us, teaching us, showing us how to realize the true potential of what it means to be a human being. And obviously, to be able to manifest the capacity for happiness and well-being in our life, that is not conditioned on circumstances, right? In other words, most of us are happy when things are going our way. But then we are unhappy when things are not going our way, or things are not turning out the way we want. We are peaceful when things are going well. But we are agitated or angry or anxious or whatever when we're presented with situations that we'd rather not have in our life. So for most of us, our emotional happiness and well-being and stability, calmness, etc., is unfortunately very conditioned by circumstances, which in a certain way is a kind of a slavery. We are slaves to external circumstances because that conditions kind of, we could say, our mind. We really want it to be the opposite, right? And so what we're learning in simple practices such as sitting and walking meditation is how to cultivate without any external artifices or without any external conditions, but actually fairly neutral circumstances, to learn how to cultivate a state of inward calmness, relaxed, open, right? And which a kind of natural happiness or good feeling or sense of well-being will naturally arise. It's not something that has to be manufactured. You know, because of the way we've been raised in the society, et cetera, or we just haven't had the opportunity to be exposed to these types of teachings or practices, most of us don't know that, right? So we spend endlessly our life trying to get certain types of conditions or certain things in our life that we think when we get these things, then we'll be happy, then we'll be peaceful, fulfilled, etc. But when we practice the wonderful practices of mindfulness, learning how to live in the present moment, learning how to concentrate the mind, etc., one realizes, no, that all emotionality arises in the mind. And if I have a kind of intelligent and skillful relationship with my mind and the things that arise in it, I do not have to be the slave of conditions. I have the capacity to generate my own inner peace, my own inner calm, and my own inner well-being, kind of almost irrespective of circumstances, more or less. And that's freedom. It's not political freedom, which we are probably most concerned with in our society, but it's inner freedom. It means I am not, again, conditioned, enslaved by the circumstances of my life, the conditions of my life, but I have the freedom to be happy, to be at peace, solely on my own capacities. So please remember that that's what we're doing here. That's what we're doing here. That's what you're doing at home. We are learning how to live happily, freely, openly, spaciously, right? Just as we are. And that's a wonderful thing to know, that is possible. That is why we're grateful to receive, to come into contact with these types of teachings that are, again, sort of counter, it's a counter message that we are, most of us have grown up with. It's only about through the acquisition of things or certain types of statuses or, you know, relationships, et cetera, that this is our only means of happiness and well-being. So it's nice to know that some things in life are free and and are sort of our birthright. We are all heirs to this natural, open, spacious, calm mind. And again, the practices, all the various types of practices of meditation and mindfulness and insight are really all about developing at a greater and greater level that capacity to be truly human and to really enjoy this precious human birth. So that's one thing. So before we return to our teachings, we always begin with any questions. Anybody who's been here a while or is new has any questions about the practices we do tonight, done tonight, or more openly in terms of how one lives the practices, brings them into all aspects of one's daily life, which means personal, interpersonal, family, relationships, work, society. So anybody have any questions? Please don't be shy. Yes. What is your name?
Ernest.
Ernesto. Ernesto, yes, Ernesto.
It's a simple question.
Yes.
Where the mind is located?
What?
Well, the location of the mind.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Ernesto, where, if you just don't think, right? And if I asked you, where is your mind located? Which means you could find it, right? Can you find your mind? Well, I'm not asking you what you believe. We can believe anything, right? You know, but I'm asking you just as very concretely, right? When you look for your mind, this thing called the mind, right? Which people tell us we have, right? When you look for it, can you find it?
If I don't think, maybe I cannot find it.
Well, hold on. If I said, Ernesto, you know, if you couldn't find your necklace, right? You're wearing a necklace, right? And if you're ready to go out in the morning and you can't find your necklace, do you have to think or do you have to just look for it?
Both.
Well, you both, but you have to look for it, don't you?
Yes.
I mean, if you think it's in the other room, you just thinking it's there doesn't mean you know it's there, right? You have to go find it. Then when you find it and hold it in your hand, you go, oh, this is my necklace is in the other room. All right. So if we say we have something called a mind, which most of us go around talking this way, and we've certainly been taught this, and if I said, Ernesto, okay, this mind of yours, when you look inside or outside, can you see it? Interesting, isn't it? Yeah. We do a lot of this kind of stuff, right? We talk about things, but we don't really look deeply. So I think that's a wonderful question. This mind, is it inside or outside? Where is it? What is it? Right? You know, these are the kind of questions the Buddha asked himself, and when he was able to answer them, he became a Buddha. So please come up with your own answer. Okay, good question. Yes. What is your name?
Chris.
Chris, yes, Chris.
What's been coming up a lot for me lately, I'm working with a therapist that's trying to encourage me to be mindful and to be in the body as far as my emotions and what is that, you know, to be in the body. I haven't really figured out what that means.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean to be in the body? How does that relate to thoughts and feelings? Is that complicated?
No, it's very simple. Actually, you know, please understand that the Buddhist teaching is all about this. You know, I mean, in some of the earliest basic sutras of the Buddha, which are his basic teachings, like the Anapanasati, which is a famous full awareness of the breath sutra, one of his earliest sutras. Basically, the Buddha teaches mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of sensations, mindfulness of the mind, which means thoughts, feelings, perceptions of the mind, and mindfulness of objects, the things that we appear. So awareness of the full realm of our body-mind is what the practice of mindfulness is about. Okay? So the practice of mindfulness is not simply to be mindful that you're drinking a cup of tea. It's also to be aware of your body, of your breath, of feelings, of emotions, of thoughts, of perceptions, right? We want to be able to... Mindfulness is just like a light, right? Like a flashlight, which we can shine, you know, I mean, you can shine your flashlight anywhere, can't you? Anything you want to shine some light on to see. So mindfulness is just your capacity to shine your light wherever you want, right? And obviously... since very much what we are is body, right, and mind, thoughts, feeling, perceptions, and obviously this is where, really, where you know, where this is what we are as human beings, right? We are bodies and we are minds. Obviously, our capacity to be present to the reality of who and what we are and our experience is means to be to enter into the full humaneness, right, of who we are. So. And again, that's new for many of us, because we spend most of our life just involved in our thoughts, or our fantasies, or, you know what I'm saying, or emotions, without ever really stopping to really watch them, to be aware of them, and to see them in the context of all these other things that are arising. So that's why in the practice of mindfulness, we want to kind of slow it down and begin to be attentive. So you have a body, right? Would you grant me that? Yeah, so your body. And you say, what does it mean to be aware of my body? Well, it means to be in touch with the sensations that are going on in your body. Right? In other words, sitting there, can you feel the way your buttocks are touching the cushion? So we could say that's a bodily sensation. Right? Can you feel the way your hand is resting against your leg? Can you feel that? Can you feel your chest? And can you feel it rise and move as you breathe? Yeah. So these are all sensations. So you know what I mean. So as you move in awareness through your body, inside organs or muscle groups, right? This is awareness of the body, right? I mean, is that what your question is?
Yeah, I guess I was trying to make the connection, because I mean, to recognize your thoughts, for me, it's a lot more easier now. I recognize my thoughts. So if I'm thinking anxious thoughts or something that's upsetting me, I can recognize the thoughts, and it's easier to combat them, so to speak. But with the body, it's a little bit more difficult. I might be able to tell myself, well, I have to feel irrational, feel anxious about this particular thing, so rational. But in my body, I still
But again, what you want to do, in using your mindfulness is, and this takes a little time, because usually when we feel something, especially when we feel something or aware of something that we perceive as negative, we react, right? Bad. But in the practice of mindfulness, it's really learning just to be aware, right? So what you are calling... anxiety or something in the body, right? And it could be anything, right? What I would say to you, if you're using mindfulness, It means you're able to be present to what's in your body, right? The sensations that are in your body, and just to be aware of them. Right? I am aware that what? I have a tightness in my chest. Right? I'm aware I have a tightness in my stomach. I'm aware that my breathing is a little shallow. That's all. And whatever other sensations are arising. So the first step is learning, and this is whether all kinds of emotions or all kinds of sensations, can we learn just to be present? Right? In the same way you could see, you know, I'm aware that I have anxious thoughts, or I have sad thoughts, or I have angry thoughts, I have resentful thoughts, I have jealous thoughts, right? But usually we when these things arise, we go with them. We follow the storyline and get lost. But in this practice, this is like when we sit. Right? The wonderful thing about sitting practice is, and especially if you make a commitment, whether in a group or by yourself, not to move, is what? You have to stay present. Or you have the capacity of going, no matter how bad I'm feeling, I can't move. So what? I'm either going to endlessly make stories in my head about it, or I'm just going to what? Be aware. I'm bored. I'm aware there's boredom in me. I'm aware there's anxiety in me. I'm aware there's this uncomfortableness in me. You know, and learning just to hold that awareness, right? And not make a big deal about it. Oh, curious. Present. Right? Now again, if it is something such as anxiety, and then if you then want to begin to calm, right? That's good. That's taking some action, which is beneficial. But it's no different whether you do it for yourself or you do it for anybody else. I mean, part of being a compassionate person, which is, again, one of the things we're up to in this practice, part of things about being a compassionate person is what? Is that when you encounter someone suffering, you what? You want to help them, right, if you can. So sometimes we often encounter ourselves as suffering. Right? And so it would seem just very natural that if we encounter that we're suffering from anxiety, from sadness, from fear, from impatience, from, you know, frustration, all those things, it behooves us to what? To take some action once we touch. The first step is, it takes a little time to develop the capacity to be present to one's suffering and to hold it. Right? Because our first response usually is to do something, right? You know, I got to do something. Because why? Because we want to get rid of it. But that's not, you know, that's not really what it's about. Because if something has arisen in us, there may be a reason why it's arisen in us. It may be that we are acting, interacting, thinking, whatever, in ways that create the conditions for this kind of suffering in ourselves. So rather than getting rid of it right away or manipulating it right away, mindfulness gives us the capacity to be present, even to something that's painful, right? Even to a painful physical sensation or a painful emotional. And when we stop, and we develop that capacity just to be present and aware and to hold that close to us, then we have the capacity of then handling it skillfully, right? Or looking deeply into its source, calmly. So that all comes from developing this capacity of mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body, right? Mindfulness of sensations, of emotions, of thoughts, and of objects, things we hear, see, the world. So mindfulness allows us to slow it all down, right, and to see things just as they are. Anxiety, by the way, is a word, isn't it? Just a word. What is it? What does it refer to? certain types of thoughts and certain types of sensations in the body. That's all. None of which are in and of themselves deadly, are they? At the worst, they are uncomfortable. But they're all very human. And again, in this practice, we want to learn to be present to our humaneness, not to run from it, not to be scared of it, not to be uncomfortable with it, but also not to feel that I always got to immediately manipulate it. Right? We're always manipulating life. How much easier just to be hold things in awareness, create some space, some spaciousness around thoughts and feelings, and then observe them. And then in a calm, clear way, dealing with them appropriately and skillfully. What's your name again?
Chris.
Yeah, I'll try to remember that. Thank you. Any other questions? Don't be shy, but if you don't have any questions, that's fine too.
I have a question.
Yes. I see you.
Yeah.
What's your name?
Helena.
Helena, yes, Helena. Yeah, that's a good point. Because again, this mind is a tricky thing. And we want to make sure that we're dealing. So, what I would say in observation, there is no dwelling. Okay? Because, in other words, let's say I'm observing you. I mean, don't take me wrong. But let's say I'm observing you. I'm not interfering with you, right? I mean, let's say I'm observing you during the day. Right? That's what I'm doing. Well, observing you, I would let you move around and do whatever you're doing, and I would just observe you. Okay? If I was dwelling the way you're thinking, I would kind of get involved. Hey, why don't you do that again? Or what was that? Or you know what I mean? I'd be manipulating what's going on. So what we're doing in the practice, we could say, we're just stopping and looking at what's arising. Okay. Now, I would say the dwelling maybe would only come when we want to look deeply. You know, like, what's this really about? Or what's this going on here? Or what's causing this to arise? So it's not dwelling on the story, right? But it's sort of looking a little deeper into causation. And the reason we do that, again, is not just to increase our capacities to have more stories about ourselves. But again, all of this is always in the pursuit of freedom. Right? So if it is a reactive pattern, an emotional pattern, or whatever, that causes suffering, right? For you or for someone else or whatever, you know, you want to stop and look deeply so you can get at the root of things, so you can kind of get unstuck, like you're saying. Dwelling to me often means kind of obsessing, which means it's just repetitive. And that's, I think that's where people go a lot. They get into some kind of emotional pattern, reactive pattern, and they just kind of repeat it. You know, over and over and over and over again, and all that does is what? It just, it makes the hole deeper. It doesn't really produce understanding. It doesn't really produce freedom or awareness. So I think, it's sort of like Ernesto was saying. I think in Buddhism, what I've learned is, to ask the right question when stuff comes up. Like, what is this? Where is this coming from? What's the cause of this? And that, because answering that has the capacity, hopefully, of freeing us, so we can change. But dwelling just kind of, it just keeps the emotion going, the pattern going, and, you know, decades can go by. You know, if we're not careful. You know, not only hours and days and months, but years and decades. And we're still, you know, still dwelling. This is about liberation, this teaching. Which is, again, as Americans, we're not used to, you know, I mean, that's not familiar to us. Right? We're used to massaging, but we're not used to liberating. You know, liberating means really to be free of something. Right? And, you know, a lot of our psychological or whatever way of dealing with things is often more in terms of coping or massaging. You know what I'm saying? Sort of making things more comfortable or working through things enough that we can cope better. Again, I'm not, I mean, I was a psychotherapist for my professional life, so I'm not knocking that. But I'm also kind of drawing a distinction between traditional kind of therapeutic work and what I would consider Dharma work or meditative work. It's really about freeing oneself from patterns. Is that clear?
Yeah, I mean, I guess so if I have like something that sort of just sits there and doesn't seem to move, then it's okay to, because then I think, well, then I'm thinking actively.
Like what are you talking about?
Well, while I'm thinking,
Oh, so we're talking about while you're meditating. Oh, okay. This is not
I sort of have like a sort of predominant emotion or something that just seems to sit there, and just, it's kind of hard. It just, I'm sort of like, how do I, are there processes, I'm like trying not to think, in other words, or I'm trying not to, trying to let it go, I guess.
Yeah. Again, yeah, it's a process, and we develop and we change over time as our practice deepens, our understanding deepens. But now that I understand you're specifically talking about meditation, so we sit, and again, we're practicing mindfulness, okay, which means we're learning to hold whatever arises in awareness and not do anything other than be aware. So you're doing your awareness of the body, breath, and you're aware that there's a certain feeling tone in you. Okay. And you can just be aware of that. And you don't have to do anything. You know, I think if you spend time observing and not doing, you will find it is the nature of thoughts, feelings to change, to arise and pass away. That is their nature. Right? What interferes with that is our own manipulation of thoughts and feelings. We grab onto them. We glom onto them. We obsess about them. So I think what you'll find is that simply by just letting things be and letting things just move through you, staying in awareness, you will find that these patterns, you know, there's that simile of the snake. How do you deal with a poisonous snake? You don't grab them, right? You grab a poisonous snake and you get bit, right? But if you're patient, right? If you're patient, that rattlesnake or poisonous snake at some point will just kind of uncurl itself and wander off, right? And that's often an analogy with, you know, how do you deal with these kind of more painful kind of thoughts or feelings? Don't grab them. Just hold them in mindfulness and awareness, and they will, by themselves, slowly uncurl and go off, which is interesting to see, because we tend to think of thoughts and feelings as kind of discrete entities that have some kind of solidity to them. They really don't. They're like clouds, Right? They appear to have some solidity, but if you're present to them, you see. And I mean, if I asked in the spirit of Ernesto, let's say, an emotion you might feel inside would be what? That you're saying just kind of resting there. Could be. Yeah, you know, it's okay if your mind's all over the place. It's just that you don't have to be all over the place. You see, that's the problem. The problem isn't that your mind's jumping around, it's that you're following it. You know, if you just watch that mind jump around, I'm aware that I have a jumpy mind. But you just hold it. You're not freaked out. You're not feeling like you got to do something about it. You just watch it. It will slow down. Or maybe it's, maybe you're really agitated. But you don't have to be. You don't have to be. See, that's what we learn. When we learn through the practice of mindfulness meditation to watch our minds, we're not used to stepping back and watching it. Because we're so totally identified with it. But very simply, once you start meditating, you'll realize, I can be aware of my thoughts. I can be aware of feelings. I can be aware of my body. Well, that's very interesting. Because I always thought I was my thoughts. I was my feelings. But I can watch them. And they come and go on their own. Well, maybe it's not as I thought. But again, that takes time and training. Because at this point, we are habituated always to jumping right in. Now again, in terms of that, what I said earlier about deep looking, I mean, if you sit in meditation and there's some very strong feeling, and if you find that just by being aware, it still stays, you might want to then ask, where's this coming from? When I say where this coming from, I don't mean in a psychological way of, this is a repetition of what, my childhood, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but it's really like, where is this arising within me? Or the question, like Ernesto's question about the mind is, what is a feeling? What is sadness, happiness, worry, frustration? Are these things discrete entities that have definition? You might be surprised what a feeling really is. And not based on what we've read, but when we look directly into our feelings, we might be very surprised that they may not be as solid and as strong and as deeply rooted as we have been taught to believe. So, again, all this kind of stuff can be learned through the practice of meditation. Did I answer? Any other questions? So, it's been a while. I think it's been over a month since I've been here, but I wanted to continue for a little bit more from reading from The Great Path of Awakening, the classic guide to using Mahayana Buddhist slogans to tame the mind and awaken this heart, this wonderful teaching coming from the Indian via Tibetan tradition, these teachings. And they're all very short, pithy slogans. They're all just like one line, but they're very profound and simple. And I'm kind of skipping around. Here's one. It says, of the two judges, rely on the principal one. Okay, of the two judges, rely on the principal one. I like this one. And it's kind of interesting because what it says is most people rely on the external judge, right? What other people think about me, how other people perceive me, right? And so therefore, I can be acting really good, And a lot of people around might be thinking, wow, he's really got his act together, right? And because of that, I might feel really what? Great. Proud of myself, right? But yet inside, I may know that that's not true. I may know more truthfully the state of my mind and really where my actions are coming from. So, should I be more concerned about how others, in this case called, judge me? Or should I be more concerned about my own kind of more intimate and perhaps more truthful assessment of myself? And here he's saying, of the two, rely on the principal one. And the principal one has to be ourself. You know, whatever the world thinks of us, however the world judges us, you know, that's fine. But that should not be the conditioner of our behavior. And we certainly should not feel good or exceptional or positive because we've mastered the capacity to put on a positive face to the world. I'm not saying that's wrong, but what he's saying here, of the two judges, rely on the principal one. Right? Each one of us know, or should know, deeply where we're at. And where the wellspring for our actions, for our speech, the things we say and do, you know, where they're coming from. And in terms of judging our development or our capacity or our own ability to be really authentic, compassionate, selfless, to the best of our ability, human beings, each of us need to be in charge of that. Right? And again, it's nice that people think kindly of us, and it's kind of less pleasant when they think less kindly of us, but that should not be what is motivating us. That should not be the principal judge of our behavior. And that's a hard one for many people because many of us grew up in situations where we are trained very, very early how to kind of act in a certain way to get things, to get respect, to get love, to be liked, to be thought worthy of, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So after a while, we're not even aware how much our motivation in life for our actions is how other people are perceiving us. Right? But if one is kind of, we could say, on a, what I would say, let's say call it a spiritual path, which is a funny name, but really a path where we want to really transform, right? We want to really heal the parts of us that are wounded. So we can be whole. We really want to transform those aspects of our character and personality, the actions of our body, speech, and mind, which are less than healthy, right? And we really are serious about this transformation. Then we have to have a very honest, right? Capacity within ourselves to see ourselves clearly. And again, when I say that, I am not implying endlessly critical of ourselves. Right? This is not about that, because that's just another kind of ego game. But it means just really being very clear. You know, what anybody else thinks about us, we know the truth about where we're coming from. Right? And it is our commitment within each one of us. Again, to do that significant types of transformation that allows us to really function in an authentic and true way. And so I think this little sentence of the two judges rely on the principal one, I think is a very good advice. And if you are listening to this and go, well, I'm not sure I'm really in touch with the principal one, then that's a good focus for practice, right? Right? Can I find that aspect of me that speaks the truth? Can I find that part of me that really kind of knows at a deep level how I want to manifest in this world, how I want to be, how I want to act, how I want to relate, you know, in an authentic way? And can I be in touch with that and let that be my guide, unless, you know, again, the kind of reinforcement that I'm getting from everyone else, right? Is that clear? So some of us, we go, yeah, I gotta honor that more. And some of us got to go, you know, what's he talking about? You know what I'm saying? And that could be. So if it's like, what's he talking about? It means then we need to spend some time getting in touch with ourselves. And meditation is another way to do that, because in meditation we're also learning to listen deeply, hearing the voices inside us. Most of us have spent our lives, we're always listening to the voices from outside us. But in meditation we want to listen deeply to that intrinsic voice. And I think everyone has that voice. It is whether you believe it or not, it is a voice of goodness. It is a voice of love. It is a voice of kindness. But it has often, unfortunately, perhaps been covered up by lots of circumstances of our growing up. But it is there. And often it just means developing the capacity to being still, right? And listening deeply. Or again, like we said earlier, asking the right question. What is my truth in this situation? What really seems right to me? What really is, you know, what is the high road in this circumstance, in this situation, right? Do I want to take the high road in this life? Or am I content to walk the low road with everybody else? Right? You know? Well, everybody else does that, right? Isn't that what everybody else does? Or everybody else thinks? Or how everybody else eats? Or how everybody else spends their time, right? We say these things. Well, that may be true. But that might necessarily mean that's really what's best. That's really what's healthiest. That's really what is noblest. We all have that kind of nobility within us. Do you believe that? Yeah, you do believe it, don't you? Some of us, that sense of our own nobility is very small. It's like a seedling. Some of us might feel it like a good-sized plant. But either ways, it means it's there. And if it is found, and if it is attended to, it will grow. It will grow. Again, unfortunately, most of us, many of us have spent a lot of our life cultivating seeds and plants which don't really produce the kind of crop that we really want to be harvesting in our life. But with good practice, good mindfulness, we will discover the right way. Any questions or comments of the two judges rely on the principal one? I mean, anything not clear about that, or anybody want to challenge me on that one? Feel free. Yes?
It's no challenge, but I got to make what I have. First of all, I got to be a little back on the mind question, okay?
What?
The question I asked you about the mind.
Uh-huh.
And I learned a long time ago, you clear a little bit more for me what the situation is. But I began to look at the mind as a magician. The magician come in the theater and they take an airplane and they disappear the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
I do, wow. Well, you spend the time trying to see how he disappeared at the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
If you make attention, it's just an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
The plane is somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now,
mm-hmm.
judgment about that point.
Mm-hmm.
Judgment, I believe, became, because I learned from the books on Dinana and teaching.
Yeah, yeah.
Judgment became from the ego.
Mm-hmm.
The ego don't live from the past and not live from the present. The ego live from the past and the future. That's what keeps us
mm-hmm.
before.
Mm-hmm.
And about judgment is because we think we are separate.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are inside our own body.
Mm-hmm.
And because I have my body, that is my transportation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm different than you.
Mm-hmm.
This is not true. That something came from the past or whatever it is.
Uh-huh.
And I learned this little point. Because we are the king, everybody is the king of judgment.
Uh-huh.
My boss, I don't like him because he dressed like that. Mm-hmm. That lady made too much noise when she eats.
Right, so therefore, so on. So therefore?
Well, I think a good practice would be when we cast ourselves,
mm-hmm.
our mind,
mm-hmm.
ego, make those judgments.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just to say.
Just to what?
It's just say. I don't like Fred.
Oh.
But.
Okay.
But you know.
What?
It's like me. I don't like that, but it's like me.
Mm-hmm.
Like me, we are the reflection. It's just here.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if I sit down with you for a while, I like you. Why not?
You might find you don't like me.
Well, I don't like you.
That's okay. That's okay too.
It's okay, exactly. But this is just. I cannot stop to love you because I disagree with you.
Yeah.
That could be together in any situation of life because the situation we have here on the West is that materialistic separation of us.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reason we are a little behind the people from the East. And all those fixing is from the East.
Right, but you know, when you go to the East, you may find things are not quite as they were, or we think they were. But of what you're saying, Ernesto, this is something a little different. You're absolutely right about judgments and why we judge and how they separate and how we perceive ourselves. You know, if I want to go to Miami, right? And I've never been to Miami, right? I may need a map, right? Now, you may say, Fred, a map is just a piece of paper and a bunch of lines. You know, you don't need that, right? You can just drive. But I don't know how to get to Miami, right? So at this point, I need a map, right? When I've done that trip several times, I won't need the map anymore, right? But we have to see the spiritual path as a process, right? And there are certain things we may say, you know, there may be, as our practice develops, and as we free ourselves from the tyranny of thought and the tyranny of self and the tyranny of conditioning, right, that we are very free. But on the way there, oftentimes, when the mind does not have that capacity to see clearly, to have that capacity to discriminate, but from a sense of that which is conducive to suffering and that which is conducive to well-being. Right? That's a very important distinction because one path causes suffering for ourselves and others and one path causes happiness and well-being for ourselves and others. Once I've developed that capacity in myself to see clearly, right? I don't need those kinds of... I don't need to read books. And I don't need maps, right? But one has to be clear where one's at, right? If one's there, good. But oftentimes in the early stages of our practice, we need good teaching to guide us. The same way, if we don't know the terrain, we need a good map. We need a good guidebook, and we need a good guide, right? But once we have good experience with the terrain, then we may not need that anymore. So again, this is a question for each of us. Right? How much do I need to rely on the teachings? How much do I need to rely on a teacher? How much structure and support do I need in my unfolding? Because at this point, when I listen to myself, I may just hear a lot of confusion, or I may hear a lot of conditioning. So it's like that. Here's an interesting one. It says, change your attitude, but remain natural. Change your attitude, but remain natural. I like this one. Because a lot of times we think, now that I'm embarking on a spiritual path, a meditative path, mindfulness path, dharma path, spiritual path, metaphysical path, whatever, I really got to change, you know, how I look, how I dress, people I hang out with, you know what I mean? Or at least I got to let everybody know, right, that I'm now something special. Right? But, so we want to, you know, we become obnoxious to our friends and our relatives, our family members, you know, as we let them know that we are significantly different from them. So I think this is wonderful advice. And it'll save us a lot of suffering ourselves, and probably save our friends and family and work colleagues a lot of obnoxious behavior. Change your attitude, but otherwise remain natural. Which I think is, again, I think what that means is quite simple. That these the practices that we're undertaking are about a real transformation, which is primarily in the way we view things, the way we, you know, where we're coming from in life, which will hopefully manifest in the way we talk and the way we act and things like that. But other than that, we don't have to, put on airs. We don't have to think we're something special. We don't have to begin to act differently. I mean, if anything, we want to be, we want people to be comfortable with us who are around us. I mean, if we're people who want to be of help to others and express kindness to others and be of support to others, we certainly don't want to go around acting in ways that separate ourselves. So even though we embark on a spiritual path, outwardly, nobody needs to know. Right? We can dress the same and look the same, even though we may be changing our eating habits and our other habits and our socializing habits or whatever. It doesn't have to be a big deal, right? And it doesn't have to be a special performance. And especially doesn't, we don't have to get on some kind of evangelical kick trying to convert everybody, And we certainly don't want to make our spiritual practice a source of suffering to other people. I mean, I remember this person once, family's ready to go off, they got to leave, and the person's, no, I got to meditate, and the whole family's waiting while dad meditates. Right? Well, you know, it's kind of like this is becoming a separation, right? You know, it doesn't mean that we don't... That perhaps in our family life and home life, we may not be introducing things in our life which other family members and friends are not part of. But it doesn't have to be in a very strongly defined way. Do you know what I'm saying? It can be flexible, right? And we can also, be attentive to the other people in our life, and not make our spiritual practice something that separates ourselves from them or makes them feel like we think we're better than them or superior to them or we're deeper than them or, you know what I mean, all that kind of stuff. So we have to be careful because often we get that way, don't we? We do think we found something special and we are living life in a deeper, more profound way and we have found the meaning of things and, you know, and again, we can get a little missionary zeal. or else we can be a little feel a little superior. And again, that's not good, because it projects a message to other people that may be hurtful to them. So it's a little tricky. On the other hand, it doesn't mean that we don't embrace in a very personal way a different kind of life and a different way of seeing things, right? But that's really the key thing, right? I mean, a lot of times these days, because we don't grow up, let's say, in terms of Buddhism, because we don't grow up in a Buddhist culture, a Dharma culture, oftentimes, we have people, married people in relationships, parents and children, where one party, may embrace the meditative life, the mindfulness life, the Dharma life, and their spouse, their partner, their friends, their children may not, right? That's probably more common than the whole family jumping in. And so, my sense always has been, if one is really practicing deeply, and if there are not other circumstances, of course, that could be contributing, that basically the spouse, partner, child should be very supportive of the person's practice. Because what? Because they should be seeing that, since they've started practice, they're kind of softer, they're more easygoing, they're more flexible, they're kinder, they're more compassionate, they seem to listen better. You know what I'm saying? So the practice in its manifestation, all things being equal, should really enhance one's capacity to fulfill one's role within relationship, families, work, etc. So that's, and if it's just causing lots of battle, again, there are obviously lots of circumstances in relationships these days which have nothing to do with practice that may be causing problems in relationships. I'm not getting into that. But I'm saying per se, it's just something to be aware of. Again, because just the nature of the historical circumstances in which Buddhism and meditation and things like that are just kind of coming into our culture, and that, again, it's often embraced by one party and not the other party. And that's just the way it is. But it doesn't have to be, create schism, right? I mean, sometimes when I talk to couples and one practices and the other doesn't, I often say, well, she's got to practice, because you're just, probably there already, the one who doesn't practice, so you don't have to practice because you're probably already more calmer. But people like us, we have more problems, so we need to practice. So that's another way of looking at it. Any questions about change your attitude but remain natural? I mean, this is really wonderful advice, especially early on in practice. The practice is about naturalness. In the Zen tradition especially, the ideal practitioner is not a saint, right? Is not somebody who walks on water, who's not somebody who's holier than thou. It's really somebody who's just totally natural, totally themselves, no artifice at all, no disingenuousness at all, everything honest and open and sincere and natural and simple, right? And that the natural personality of the individual shines through, right? What the practice should be doing is getting rid of all the contaminations, all the deformations, all the skewedness of personality and character and action, which has really repressed, right, one's naturalness of who one is. Is that clear? This is important. you know, as you practice, you should not be, practice should not be something that represses you. Practice should be something that frees you. And again, it doesn't free you to be a bastard. You know, it doesn't free you to be a jerk. It doesn't free you to be, I mean, to do harm to other people. That's not what we want to free. You know, we can do that quite well on our own without practice. It should just free us, you know, for that deeper sense of who we are, right? To come out. And that all the kind of holding back and all the repression and all the kind of manipulative actions we're involved in because we're always trying to use our speech or use the actions of our body to get something, right, is no longer there. It's all gone, right? So your actions in life can be very free, natural, spontaneous. Is that clear? So it's important, you know, that we don't, because some people kind of get into spiritual practice and it becomes like a straitjacket, you know, or like a, you know, like a suit, you know, like a tight-fitting suit, you know, that just kind of inhibits them because you think you have to be a certain way. I mean, again, we do have to stop something, but what we have to stop doing is things that create harm, that create suffering for ourselves and others. You know, that's what we have to stop. And we have to start doing things that create happiness and well-being. So there's a certain kind of do's and don'ts. But it's not personal, you know what I'm saying? It's more has to do with the effects of our actions. That's what we want to watch. So, if you've been practicing a while, and the longer you practice, you should feel freer, right? You're able to be more spontaneous. Because oftentimes we're not spontaneous because why? Because we're so concerned about others' judgment. How we'll be perceived and how we'll be thought of and whether, right? And that's all, again, that's all external. Right? That's something we've learned to constrict us. The practice is about uncovering the kind of natural goodness that is present within each of us. The kind of natural open-heartedness. Again, as Ernesto pointed out, a lot of this has to do with identification of ourselves as a self, a separate, discrete entity. That's often what constricts us. Because we see ourself as different than all the other selves. And so there's just all this kind of figuring it out. But when you lessen that overlay of self, that overlay of conditioning, that overlay of being primarily concerned about how the world perceives rather than what it's like to be in the inside, things will begin to change for each and every one of us. Are there any questions about that one? So we've done of the two judges, rely on the principal one, change your attitude but remain natural. Is there any questions about how to practice these? Everybody's committed. Good. We'll do one more and then we'll stop. Here's a good one. Give up all hope for results. See, these are very short, but they carry a lot of weight. That's why they're called pith teachings. They're like little grenades, you know. They just kind of, you go, what? I mean, isn't this all about, I mean, haven't I been going on about an hour about getting different results in life, and now it's like, give up all hope for results. So it's good teaching means whenever we think we kind of get it, or we found a good resting place, the teacher comes along and just pulls out the rug a little bit. You know, so every time we feel a little safe. So now he says, give up all hope for results. That's a wonderful teaching. You know, I think there's several meanings in that. I mean, there's a lot can be said, but simply it means, you know, expectations, living in the future, postulating where we think this is going to lead us, right? All those things not only create and reify a fixation, but then also it means that we are always end up with either happiness or disappointment, right? Or frustration. If we see that we are not getting the results that we think we should be getting or deserve. So it's a kind of setup that prevents us from really seeing that there is a mystery and an unknowing in this practice. Right? Now, obviously, we undertake the practice because somebody, either somebody you've read or somebody you've come to hear or talk to, is kind of telling you by doing these practices, you will get good results, right? So in a certain sense, like everything else, we have to understand things have multiple meanings on different levels, right? Because if we didn't think that this meditation or this spiritual path or this Dharma or this Eightfold Path wasn't going to give us results, why undertake it? Might as well just, go down to the bar, right? Have a good time. Why do this? So obviously, we enter the path, we enter these practices, because we have a sense of trust, faith, belief that the things we've read or the persons we've heard give talks to talk to us and the results that we see in them or they say is achievable through this is possible, right? That gets us going, right? So coming back to Ernesto, right, it's like, yes, if you follow this map, you can get to Miami. We need to know that or we won't follow the map. So in a certain sense, that is a motivator. But what this is saying is, now that you're going, you don't have to think about the results, right? Now that I'm on 75, right, I can just drive. And I can just, be present every moment, the unfolding of the journey, whatever happens I deal with, right? I don't have to always be going, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Because, to say, are we there yet, to say is, how come the results I expected are not here yet, means that we are what? We are discounting the present. Right? Because this present is not what I expected, so therefore I'm not happy with it. I'm dissatisfied with it, right? So we sit in meditation. What's over there, Helena. See, now Helena, if she said, well, I'm going to sit in meditation, the results will be I'm going to have a good meditation, right? My mind's going to be calm and focused, right? Now that's, to have that intention at the beginning is whatever. But then it unfolds, doesn't it? Right? It unfolds. And here it is. And if you keep thinking about how it was supposed to be or how it should be, frustration, disappointment, right, or et cetera. But the truth is, the practice is not just becoming good meditators, it's learning how to be without judgment. Right? So, in that moment, this is who you are, and this is the way your mind is. And the question is, can I be totally present to it and be okay with it? Right? Be calm, be peaceful. Even with an agitated mind, right? So, the long term, we expect a certain type of transformation and healing from this process, right? Going back to our analogy, staying on 75, I do expect to get to Miami, right? But I don't have to be thinking about it. the whole journey, do I? If I go, there's only Tampa, and then there's getting to Miami, and nothing else in between matters. Unfortunately, that's our life. You know, this is our life. And if we think life only matters when I get to Miami, right, I'm not going to be happy or very attentive, right, to how my life unfolds between Tampa and Miami. So that's what it means. Don't be attached to results. Give up all hope. Give up all hope means, you know, whatever will be, right? I will make my best effort, right? When it comes to meditation, she's sincere, but she sits down, the mind's just a mess. It's okay. I'll deal with it. Be present, be aware, do my best to calm it, clarify it. That's all. We're present to whatever is. Right? So give up all hope. You know, you do an action, right? I do something, I think I want to help Brian. My motivation is pure. Brian thinks, what a jerk he is. Here I am trying to be a good guy, and what happens? Well, Brian's not happy with me. If all I cared about were the results, right, then I'd be upset, disappointed. But if, you know, if all I know is, you know, I did my best, right? I was trying to help. Didn't work. It's okay, right? There'll be other opportunities. Do you see what I mean? This give up all hope for results, don't be attached to results, is a very important kind of practice in our tradition. Again, it means we're not living in the externals, right? Where we're not living for, you know, what we get back. We live authentically because that's the way we want to live. Do you see? And whether they respond the way and see you know, the goodness of our motivation or not, whether they think we're great or helpful or whatever, it doesn't matter, does it? Because we're not attached to results. That's not what we're doing it. So this is, again, a wonderful, it's a pith teaching, but it has lots of meaning for us. Give up all hope for results. Just do it. And see what happens. Be curious about what's going to happen. And whatever happens, you just deal with it, right? But you don't let it sway your commitment to your own transformation, to living authentically your own life. So of the two judges, rely on the principal one, change your attitude but remain neutral, and give up all hope for results. See if you can practice them in the coming week. Of the two judges, rely on the principal one, change your attitude, remain natural, give up all hope for results. Thank you. We'll stop here.